For those of you that I don't know, my name is Brittany. Whenever I joined this church 8 years ago, I think now, I was married to Dan Johnson, who most people here know, like they are at least familiar with that name. And you would probably remember that Dan passed away January of 2018, so a year ago and a few months. So to tell you a little bit about myself, I was raised in Apple Springs. My mom had me when she was young, so she was single, and I was raised primarily by my mother and my grandparents, and had a really great childhood. So when at the time, it seemed so average and ordinary. You know, you're just a kid and things were great, but looking back, I have to think that's probably the first example that I have of God's grace in my life, because I had these wonderful people, a really strong mother, and these grandparents, and I even had my great-grandparents who lived less than a mile away, and I had 11 first cousins all within 1 mile of me, and it was just a really blissful, fun childhood. I was raised in church. My great-grandfather was a Church of Christ preacher, so pretty old-fashioned one-room church that I went to, and I think almost every member there was part of our family. Really, so that's kind of fun, and you know, you were expected to be there on Sunday morning, and you were expected to be at family lunch on Sunday afternoon, and everything that we did was kind of with our family, and I just thought that that was normal, and now that I'm older, I realize that that is not at normal at all, and it's a pretty cool gift. So I had a great childhood, and grew up, and I'm going to abbreviate some things because I want to make sure that I have time to talk about the really important stuff. So I graduated from high school, had a great experience there, and I went on to Sam Houston State University. I did not know at all what I wanted to do whenever I was in my first 2 years of school. So I lived in a dorm, and I took a bunch of classes, and I was kind of just having fun and trying to figure it out. I knew that I would do something that involved some kind of science, and something that involved people, because I love people. And that was as far as I got. So after 2 years, it occurred to me that maybe I would go to nursing school. I don't know, that sounded like a good way to kind of combine everything. And at the time, Sam Houston did not have a nursing program. So I said, well, I'm gonna apply, and it's okay. That, you know, that'll be good. They have a program, it's the same size school. And I moved home, or I had plans to move home at the end of the semester. But some friends called and said, hey, we're going to go to this concert in Nacogdoches. You should come with us. It'd be a good chance for you to meet some people here. And I said, okay, great. I'll go home for the weekend. I'll meet some people before I actually start going to school here. So I did that and met up with my friends, and we go to this bar. I'm just going to say it. Sorry. Sorry. So we go to this bar. And I'm standing in line, and if you've ever gone to a bar and you're underage, they put a big black X on your hand to let everybody know that you're underage. So I'm standing in line for my big black X because I was 20. And across the bar was this man. And he was tall and handsome and completely unlike anybody I'd ever seen before. And he was standing there just staring at me. And I thought, okay, well, that's bizarre, but whatever. So I get to the front of the line, and I look up, and he's still staring at me. So then I'm staring at him, wondering why he's staring at me. And finally I say, well, I'm just going to have to go over there, because he probably knows me, and I just don't remember who he is. So I walk over there, and I say, hey, you know, I'm Brittany. You're staring at me. Do I know you? And he said, yeah, I think we know each other, and, you know, whatever. So we end up chatting and have a great conversation. And from that day on, Dan and I basically were never apart. It was an instantaneous attraction and just this really magical thing that happened. We literally, he was living in Longview. He had just graduated from SFA. I was still living in Huntsville. So when I finally moved home, I lived in Lufkin, and I was going to SFA, and he would drive almost every evening from Longview to Lufkin. And we would go on dates, and we had so much fun. And 6 months later, he asked me to marry him, and I said yes, and we got married. And it totally scared everybody in our family, because it was very fast, and they thought it was irrational. But I had never been more sure of anything in my entire life than I was of what I felt for him. So we got married, and I moved just outside of Longview with Dan and continued going to school. And we had a really blissful start to our marriage. It was perfect and fun and everything that it should be. I graduated nursing school, and Dan stopped working for the company that he was working for there and started working for a new consulting firm in Center. And I kind of threw my first wife fit and said, I'm not going to live in Center. I absolutely refuse. I'm not living there. So we moved to Lufkin, and he drove to Center every day for work. And we went on like that for a couple of years. Things were great. At the time, we weren't going, we were both raised in church, but we weren't going to church consistently or anything like that. We just kind of were working and living our life and just having a lot of fun. And then at about 4.5 years into our marriage, Dan got sick, and it was nothing major, we thought. I mean, he would complain of headaches, and he would have some nosebleeds occasionally and just feel congested. And I offered no sympathy at all because he loved to duck hunt, and it was winter, and he was standing in waist-deep water in the freezing cold weather. And as a nurse, I would tell him that's horrible, and you do this to yourself, so I don't feel sorry for you. Sorry. And so he took himself to the doctor, and the doctor agreed that it was probably just a sinus infection, treated him for that, and came home. And he kind of went on about his business. He went out of town again on about a week-long hunt, and then he came home, and he said, you know, my nose was bleeding really bad on this trip. And I said, well, maybe you need more antibiotics. I don't know. Maybe something is still wrong. So he went back to the doctor, and she treated him with another course of antibiotics, but this time his vision got really blurry. And the doctor wasn't concerned about that at all. I mean, it just can happen sometimes. So he ended up going to our eye doctor and asking for a change in his prescription until he got this figured out. And our eye doctor said, well, you probably have a brain tumor. And it was the most bizarre thing. So he came home and told me this. And of course, I'm like, that's insane. No, you don't have a brain tumor. You just have an infection. And he said, well, he wants me to go see another doctor. So he went to a ear, nose, and throat doctor in Nacogdoches, and I did not go with him because I just was so sure it was nothing. And I was at work at the hospital when the phone rang, and it was a nurse asking me to come to the doctor's office. And I said, you know, I'm at work. I can't leave my patients. You can't just leave the hospital like that. And she said, well, we really need you to come because there's something going on. And I said, well, I can't. So just tell me what it is. It's okay. And the doctor took the phone from her and said, Ms. Johnson, your husband has a brain tumor. You need to come here now. And I was like, okay, I will clock out and I will come that way then. So I left work. And the whole way in Nacogdoches, I was driving and I was praying, but I was also thinking, this is just absurd. This is the craziest thing that I've ever heard. Dan was 29 years old. I was 25 years old. I was like, this just does not happen. And I was like, you know, these local doctors probably just, you know, they don't really know what they're seeing. So I got there and we immediately went and had an MRI done, and they read it that day, one of the brain surgeons in Nacogdoches. And I'll never forget, because he was pacing outside the door. There was a gap and you could see him pacing back and forth. And it hit me that something really bad was going on, because he paced back and forth probably 10 times. And then he stopped in front of the door and I could see his little shoes. And he stood there for what seemed like an eternity. And I'll never forget, you know, Dan looked at me and said, it's probably nothing. And I said, no, it's something, because the doctor's standing there, and he would just come right in. And I just had this really gut feeling that something was wrong by the way that he did that. I came in, and he said, listen, I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I've never seen this in real life. You have chordoma. It's very rare, 1 in a million people, but that's what you have. And I don't know where to send you, so you can give me a few days to figure it out. And, of course, Dan was stunned and just kind of sitting there and glazed over at that point. And I was like, well, how, if you've never seen it, how how can you be sure? And he said, no, I'm sure. That's what this is. So we left, and it's on the way to the parking lot. I do what everybody does, and I'm Googling because I've never heard of Cordoma. I don't know what it is. And immediately, all these horrible results are popping up. And I'm seeing things, you know, they're one in a million people, and I'm seeing no known cure. And I'm seeing, you know, no patients alive after 7 years. And I'm seeing all these horrible things. So I put that away because that's not helpful. And drive home, and the whole time I'm like, it's probably a misdiagnosis. There's no way he diagnosed something that rare on the first try. Like, that just doesn't happen. So we come home, and we have to call Dan's parents because they have no idea that anything's been going on at all. And he doesn't call them because you're the nurse. So I called them and said, they think that Dan has a brain tumor. And of course, they were terrified and worried. They lived in Lubbock, so they were 9 hours away from us. And other than that, we made a decision that day to keep it very quiet. We weren't going to tell a lot of people. It was probably nothing. We weren't going to get people riled up. We were only going to tell our parents, and that was going to be that. And that was really important to Dan because he was really private, and he was really worried about his career. And he was in a place at work where things were, he could be coming up for a big promotion, and he didn't want to be passed over on that for something like this. So we made that decision, and we called the doctor the next day and said, where are you sending us? And he said, I still don't know. I've called a lot of people, and I don't know what to do with you yet. And I said, okay, well, this is ridiculous. So again, the Cordoma Foundation had a list of doctors that are specialists, so I looked them up and read all about them, and there was one at Methodist in Houston who we wanted to use. And so I called him, and he said, well, that's fine, I'll see you, but I have a 3-week wait list. And we were like, you can't wait 3 weeks. This is devastating news. We need to know what's going on here. So I called a friend of mine who's a doctor and said, listen, this is what's going on. Any strings that you could pull would be really helpful. And he said, well, what's the name? And I told him, here's a major example of God's grace. He said, oh, I know him. No big deal. He called me back and said, he'll see you in the morning at 8 a.m. So that was the first example in that situation of how God really does line everything up. So what are the chances that a local doctor here knows this high-end brain surgeon at Methodist and can just call him when he's on the golf course and get us in the next morning? And so we got ready the next morning and we went to Methodist, and we're thinking we're all going to have this great laugh, right? And we're going to sit there and the doctor's going to come in and he's going to say, somebody's an idiot and they don't know what they're doing. But that didn't happen. He came in and he said, who's the name of the doctor that diagnosed this? And we told him, and he said, well, you need to go and thank him because he just diagnosed this right on the first time, and I've never seen that done in my career. So we're like, okay, wow, that's awesome. Good for him, but this is horrible news. So he said, well, we need to do brain surgery. And I'm thinking in terms of how we do things, like you need to have surgery, you schedule it, you come back for labs, you do these things. And he said, no, Ms. Johnson, you're going to go, you're going to take your husband upstairs, and he's going to have labs drawn, and you're going to be back at 4 a.m. in the morning, and we're going to do brain surgery. And we were pretty devastated. We didn't even pack a bag. We thought we were just going for a checkup. So we went and did the labs and did all this imaging and called his parents, who immediately got in the car, and if they left right that minute, they would make it just as they were wheeling Dan into the operating room. And so we called everybody, and we ended up spending the night at Dan's best friend's house, who lives in Houston. And I'll never forget laying in bed that night and just holding hands and praying, because we knew it was going to be a big surgery. It was going to be a 12-hour surgery. Dan didn't feel like he had time to prepare. He was very, very nervous about it. He'd never even had labs drawn before that day. So for somebody who had never had, I mean, nothing. So, of course, when they were drawing his labs, he was having an anxiety attack, and I'm telling him he's having brain surgery the next day. Like, this is small potatoes. But he ended up having his surgery. It was a 12-hour surgery. The doctor came out, and he knew that he did not get all of Dan's tumor. that first time. And that was pretty devastating because during that time I had been reading everything that I could get my hands on about Cordona. And I knew that if they don't get it all the first time, the chance of seeding and all of that is much higher. And so he was going to have worse outcomes. But we said, okay, so the plan was for us to go back 30 days later, have another brain surgery to get the rest of it out, and then start radiation. So we did that. He had his second brain surgery, followed by a summer long of radiation, which was horrible. Dan continued to work that whole time remotely. He stayed in Houston. Our friends owned a condo that they so graciously let us have for the summer. And he worked remotely from there. I would drive home in the mornings. I would work at the hospital all day, and then I would drive back to Houston at night to be with him because he just had a hard time recovering after his surgery. We came home. He immediately went back to work, recuperated, and our plan was just to move on. We didn't want to tell anybody. We didn't tell anybody at church. We didn't. Our parents knew, and his boss knew, and that was about it. And we weren't home a week, probably, before he went back to work and tried to just carry on like normal. And he did well. He got better. Things were going really, really well. So during that time, some changes started happening for us, because up until Cordona, Dan and I had a good marriage. It was a very normal marriage. We loved each other, but we were very, very career-driven and focused. It was the only thing that we cared about, to the point that we rarely saw each other because we worked all the time. And it was nothing for one of us to say, I'm going to go ahead and work 7 days this week instead of five. And we really didn't prioritize our marriage or each other. And so looking back now, I can tell you that, and Dan and I had this conversation many times, had he not gotten Cordona and we had continued on the track that we were on, our marriage would not have survived. We didn't prioritize it. We didn't prioritize church. We let our careers be our sole focus. And I don't think it's not horrible, but looking back, I'm forever thankful that he got Cordona, because we learned in a split moment how to love each other better and what was important. So another example of God's grace, because our marriage was truly changed for the better because of that diagnosis. So that was the first change. And then the second change was that we decided, I decided that I wanted a baby. We had never wanted children when we met. We were on the same page that we didn't want children. Children were terrible. They're messy. They mess up your house. They mess up your schedule. You don't get to travel. You have all these horrible things that come from having children. But suddenly, I just had this tug on my heart that I wanted a baby. And so I started praying about it, because how do you tell someone that you've known for 5 years, that you've been telling for 5 years that you don't ever want to do that, that you do? And also, how do you tell the person that basically has a death sentence that you want a baby? So I prayed a lot about it. And finally, one day I said, okay, I just have to say it. Like, there's no nice way to say this. There's no way to hint at it. So we had a very honest conversation. And I said, you know, I want a baby. Everything that's happened has totally changed my view of what's important in life, and I don't think it would be so horrible to do that. And he was like, I agree. I've changed my mind on that. We were way off. We were wrong. But I'm going to die. I know that I'm going to die. It's just a matter of when. And he said, you know, is that responsible? Is it a good thing to do? And I don't know. You know, today I think we made the right choice. But we prayed a lot about it. We cried a lot about it. We talked to his doctors, who said, you can try, but you probably won't get pregnant now that you've had a lifetime maximum of radiation. But we decided that we would try. And if it was meant to be, it would happen. So we tried 2 months and we got pregnant. And we had our daughter 9 months later, who was perfect and healthy and is a miniature Dan walking around, which is kind of funny. And Dan was healthy my entire pregnancy. We thought, well, this is great. This is what was meant to happen. This big thing happened to change our view on what's important. And now life's just going to go on, and that's great. We've learned our lesson. So we had our daughter, and we went in for Dan's routine checkup whenever she was 3 months old, because he went every 3 months then. And we took her with us because the doctors, they wanted to see this little baby that, you know, they were all excited about. So we go, and it was 2 days worth of appointments and showing her off. And the last appointment that we had was where they read the scans, and they said, sorry to tell you that your tumor's back. So that was probably my first real freak out, if I have to say, because here we have created this little life, and how could God have allowed that to happen if he knew this was going to happen? I had no understanding of that. Everything was supposed to be fine now, and that's why we had this great thing happen. And so we went home and we were totally devastated because we felt horrible and we felt guilty that we had done that. You know, it felt wrong for some reason. And Dan went into a pretty deep depression after that. He felt like he had just ruined, you know, this child's life. And we just started coming to church more. And we were on Wednesday nights with David and Kathy. So we would come more, and we stopped being secretive about what was going on. And we had to really get a grip, because we had to have help at this point, because he was going to have more surgery, and he was going to have radiation. So we had to get honest with ourselves about what we were facing and what it meant. And once we opened up and we started sharing our story and sharing the fact that he did have this devastating diagnosis, but we were going to continue to live through it, and we were going to do all of that, and we started praying about it and realizing that we're not in control, things started getting better emotionally. But all of that being said, it was still very hard. So there's so much more that I could go on about that, but I like to tell y'all about the part about my daughter, because that's so important, because without her, I couldn't tell the rest of the story. You know, she really was the cornerstone of all of that. And without her, I don't believe that Dan would have lived as long as he lived. He loved her and really needed her, and she gave him a lot of hope and a lot of reason to fight as long as he did. So we fast forward now through, 15 brain surgeries, because from that moment on, he was sick. He never was healthy again from the time that she was 3 months old. And then to the last probably 2 years of Dan's life. Him being sick became a very normal part of our life. He was lifelighted twice. He had 2 major brain bleeds, a brain surgery, at least 1 a year. And we did chemo. We did all these experimental things, a doctor on each coast and a doctor in Houston. And we did that raising our daughter. She never missed a doctor's appointment with us. She never missed a surgery. She never missed anything. And that was just our normal. To the point, I kind of started thinking that's what everybody does. I don't know. That's just kind of how we spend our time. And then when we were at home researching anything that could possibly buy him more time. And it sounds really stressful, and it was. But at the same time, it was amazing. Because we learned to live in the moment, and we learned to focus on what was important. And now, in the meantime, we had to sell our home. We sold everything basically that we own, and it was kind of crazy, you know, like looking back. But at the time, it didn't matter. I didn't need all of those material things that I thought that I needed. We moved into an apartment, and we were so happy so long as we were together. And we continued on like that. So then it came down, he got really, really sick and ended up having to be lifelighted to Methodist and had a brain bleed. And then ended up, as soon as they put a shunt in and got him kind of stabilized, we transferred him to Seattle to his surgeon. where he ended up having another major craniotomy. So a 14-hour surgery, and the doctor came out and he said, you know, I didn't get it all, but we are going to look at some clinical trials and maybe go in and do another surgery in a couple of months. And we said, okay, that's fine. So we came home and we recuperated, and Dan didn't bounce back that time the way that we thought that he would. So we went back for our checkup, and he said, okay, well, we have to go ahead and do surgery now, so we're going to do another 14-hour surgery because he had some carotid artery involvement, and they were really worried about that. And he said, this is going to be the biggest surgery of all. It's going to be a 20-hour surgery. This is the last time that we're going to operate, and we're going to give it everything we've got. And so our family didn't come that time because we made the very not wise decision to tell them to stay home. Because every time that they came, it got really stressful. So it was easier if they stayed, and I took my daughter and just did it by myself. Because when you have so many mothers involved, things get a little crazy. So I was sitting in the waiting room, just praying and playing with the baby. And well, I say baby, she was 3 at the time. But we were sitting there when after 4 hours the surgeon came out. And I thought, okay, well, he's going to give me an update. And he came over and he said, Brittany, we're done. And I said, oh, we're done with the surgery? Yay, this is amazing. And he said, no, we're done with everything. I'm closing Dan up. I want you to take him home. I want you to put him on hospice. There's nothing else I can do. If I continue to operate on him, it's only going to hurt him. And he sat and cried and prayed with me, and it was horrible. And I was alone, and I thought, how could this be happening? This is not the way that this is supposed to go this time. So I immediately called Dan's parents, who flew up there, probably thinking, yeah, I told you so. They didn't say it. They had every right to. And they came, and Dan recuperated, and we came home 2 weeks later. The hardest part of any of it, any surgery that he never had, was the minute that he woke up, he looked at me and would say, "What? How'd they do? How did they do?" And that time, I knew he would do that because he had done that 15 other times, and I had to say, "They didn't get it." And he would say, "Well, what's next?" Always, because I was kind of the planner and what was going to happen next with him. And that time, I had to say, "Nothing. We're going to go home, and we're going to just be." And he did not handle that well. He was really devastated because our daughter was 3 and he did not want to die. So we came home and he said, you know, there's got to be something else. There has to be something else that I can do. So I get on the internet and I'm researching. And I find this doctor in New York who had a clinical trial where he had radiated people with like 4 times the maximum amount of radiation you can have in their belly. And he had some pretty good results. There was no data that he'd ever done anybody's head, but we called him. And he said, sure, fly up here and see me and we'll talk about it. So we went and talked to him and he told us, I've never done this in anybody's head. It's not safe. 60% chance you will not walk, you will not talk, you will not swallow. You won't be in a bed, but I'll do it if you want to do it, because the other option was to die. And Dan said, yes, I want to do it. And he said, you know, wait, I have a thought. I have this colleague over at NYU, and he's doing a clinical trial on a chemo drug. I don't know if he's doing it for yours, but just go talk to him first. And if he won't see you or he says, no, it's not an option, come back and I'll radiate you. So we got, and he literally called in right there on his cell phone. We ran downstairs as fast as we could, got in a cab, went to NYU, and went up and met this doctor who was about my age. And he said, sure, I'll write you for the chemo. He did a genetic test on Dan. He ended up showing that it may have a little bit of effectiveness no chemo ever had before. So again, God's grace, putting us at the right place at the right time. Not necessarily the right doctor, but the right city, and the person who knew where we needed to go. So he said, also, I'm going to do you a little bit better. I have a friend that I went to med school with, and he works at MD Anderson. He's not working on this trial with me, but he is a sarcoma specialist. If you'll go see him, I'll tell him the chemo, and I'll give him all this stuff, and we'll have him write you the trial, chemo. And it was really weird, because I said, okay, well, what's his name? He said his name is Anthony Conley. Well, my daughter's name is Conley. And I said, okay, well, God, I hear you. Like, I hear that you are trying to tell me this is okay. So we went and we met Dr. Conley, who wrote me his chemo, and we did that every day for a solid year at home. And Dan did relatively well. We started in January. He worked every day. He was at home with Conley, and he even had some results from that. You know, it was pretty exciting. They wrote some really great papers about it up until August. And then in August, his chemo quit working, and he got very, very sick, and ended up having to quit his job. That's also the time that he came and met with Pastor Mark, and I know this because I read his journal. That's one of the things you get to do, I guess. So I read his journal, and he wrote an entry in August about how he was ready to go home, but he couldn't tell me, because I wanted him to keep fighting. And I did. I didn't want him to give up. And I had a really hard time with that. And he talked about how he came and talked to Pastor Mark about it. And so I guess he gave him good advice or something, because he came home and he told me, I want to stop all of this. And I, of course, I'm being a cheerleader, and I said, you're having a bad day. You need to get a better attitude. You're not going to give up. And he very sternly, the way that husbands do when they're very serious, and we know that, he said, I need you to stop being a nurse, and I need you to be my wife for a little while. And he said, I'm done. I don't want to take this anymore. I'm done. And I said, okay. And he said, the only thing I want to do is go on a camping trip. It was so bizarre. I was like, of course you do. That's the only thing you want to do is go on a camping trip. So I packed everything up and packed Conley up and packed the dog, and off we went to Mason on this great camping trip. And it was fun, and Dan was walking and he was enjoying it, and things went really, really smoothly. So he told me while we were there, laying in the tent, super uncomfortable, but it was amazing. You know, I don't think I need the chemo. I think everything is going to be okay. I'm going to die, but I don't think it's going to be tomorrow. I just don't need the chemo anymore. I just need to be. And I said, okay, you know, I understand that. And so time went on. A few months went by, and it was November, the week of Thanksgiving. And Conley's birthday is also the week of Thanksgiving. And I came home from work, and Dan was on the couch, and from the door, I could tell that something was very wrong. So I called 911 as I'm walking across the living room. An ambulance came and took him to the hospital. He had pneumonia and a major frontal lobe brain bleed. He was taken to MD Anderson, and whenever I got there with our daughter, they said, he is dying. He could possibly never leave this hospital. And so, that was kind of the beginning for me of letting go, okay? And slowly, in all honesty, I've been letting go for a while, because you see these things, you see what's happening, but you don't want to acknowledge it. But certainly in August, whenever he started talking about being done, it was very easy to see. So, we were in the hospital, and he was in a coma. So he woke up and said the same thing he always said. What'd they say? Because in his mind, he had had surgery. And I said, no, he didn't have surgery. And you have a major brain bleed, and we're going to go home on hospice. And I was exhausted by that point. And I was panicking, because how do you tell a four-year-old on her birthday that her dad is going home on hospice? Like, does she even know what that is? And And so I'll never forget, I was walking down the hall with her, and I thought, okay, God, I just prayed about it, because I don't know what else to do. Nobody had any valuable advice to offer, so I just prayed. And I said, God, just give me the words to be able to help her and to answer her questions. And we'd always been very honest with her. So I said, you know, Conley, what do you think is happening with Dad? And she said, Dad is dying. And I said, oh, okay. God, thank you. You made that very easy. And I said, well, why do you think that? And she said, well, Mom, his body's tired now. And it was so clear and easy for her to understand. So that took away a lot of my anxiety because I realized I don't have to be the one to fix anything. I don't have to be the one to have it figured out. I just have to know who to ask for the wisdom that I'm going to need. And so I decided right then and there, like from here on out, with all these questions that are being thrown at me, that's going to be my go-to. I don't have an answer, but God, please just help me be able to figure it out, or help me have the words to say, or help me know how to help them. And so we went home, and it was a hard month, but it was also one of the most beautiful months of my life. Dan was profoundly ill. He had a lot of really bad symptoms, but it was amazing. He was happy. He wanted to be at home in our bed, so that's what we did. He wanted to go outside when he wanted to go outside, and he went with Robert several times riding around the woods, and he was as pleased as could possibly be. And we kind of got into just a cycle of things were okay as they could possibly be. And everybody around us was freaking out, but for us, it was our normal. And then we had a Sunday where Dan had an actually pretty exceptional day, and he sat in the bed and he watched Moana with Conley, and the movie went off and she bounced off the way that kids do to her room. And I sat down next to him and he said, I want to tell you something. And I said, oh God, don't start saying that stuff he'd say, because he would say, when I die, I'd really like you to get remarried. And I would start crying and I would get really angry because who wants to hear that? And it seemed like something that could never happen. I said, don't start saying that again, please. And he said, no, I'm not going to say that. I just want you to listen to me. He said, I'm going to be going away soon. And then something really crazy is going to happen. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I want you to promise me that you'll be open to it and you won't rob yourself or Conley of the opportunity to be happy. And I said, okay, I can promise you that. That seems pretty reasonable. So after that, he said, you know, I love you. You've been a great wife. Thank you for never leaving me. Those were the last words that he ever said. And he went to bed that night, and he died at 6 a.m. the next morning in our bed with me next to him, just like he'd always hoped. So after that, it was pretty horrible. You know, I tell everybody I don't sugarcoat that. It wasn't pleasant. I was thankful in a lot of ways that Dan was not suffering, because he had suffered. You know, I hear stories about people who pass away and they, you know, were pleasant and they were in their sleep and they didn't suffer, and that's amazing. But Dan suffered, and he had a lot of problems, and he had a really hard mental time with the fact that he was losing his ability to do simple things. He didn't feel like he was contributing to our family or functioning as a dad. And so he had a really hard time with that. And so in some ways I was thankful that he didn't have to feel that way anymore. And I was thankful that God had finally delivered him the divine healing that I had prayed so long. God, please give him a divine healing. And in my mind, in the beginning, that was cure his cancer. And then now I see, you know, he got the best healing. He was made perfect, and he didn't have to suffer anymore. But that happened. So in some ways I was thankful, but in some ways I was devastated, because what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to raise this little child in this world by myself? I did not have a dad growing up. I did not want that for her. I thought that was horrible. And people would say, oh, you're young, life's going to go on. And that seemed so bizarre to me, because how could it? How could somebody who means so much to you be replaced? And I said, yeah, that's just never going to happen. Nobody could ever love Conley the way that Dan loved her. Nobody could be my best friend the way that Dan was my best friend. So I was content to just have my daughter. I considered that a gift, and I was by myself. So then I was sitting at work a couple of months later when I finally went back, and I got a call, and it was a very friendly bill collector from the Houston Fertility Institute who was calling to let me know that the bill on Dan's sperm had not been paid because we had sperm banked, thinking still that one day we may have another child. And I said, well, I'm sorry, he always handled that, and, you know, he's passed away, so, you know, I guess I just need to let you know that. And she said, actually, he wrote a thing in here that says, if you would like to have control of the specimen, you can. So if you would like to hold on to it, just continue to pay the bill, and if you ever want to have a child, you can. And so I thought, oh my God, wow, okay. So I prayed about it. And in a way, holding on to that was a way of holding on to Dan and holding on to a piece of him. And to be able to control my life, I wanted to continue. I wanted more children. I wanted that. So I thought, well, maybe I will. I'll hold on to it. And when the time is right, I'll just have another child. And it's okay. And the more that I thought about it, having a voice in my head saying that's not right. And I swear I said that it's God saying, if you do that, you're not having faith in me. You're not having faith in my plan for your life. And so after a couple of days of really praying about it and thinking about it, I filled out all the paperwork, and it was a huge stack, to have all of that terminated. And it was the hardest thing that I've ever done, because I was giving up the last little piece of Dan, or even hope that life would go on. But I did it, and I prayed about it and said, you know, God, please just, you know, let the right thing be easily seen. And it was. I mean, I knew that that was the right thing. And so I filled out the paperwork and turned it in, and that was done. And 1 month later, I had a chance meeting with one of Dan's friends from undergrad at SFA, who I did not really know. I'd met twice in passing over the last 10 years. And we ended up having a really great conversation. And it was so outstanding that I remember driving home thinking, that was one of the best conversations I've had in a long time. And it was refreshing to be treated normally, to not be treated like the person whose husband does not, because that's how everybody looks at you, and it's uncomfortable. And I thought, okay, well, that's odd. So then a few weeks later, I get a text message. And it's a number I don't have in my phone. So, of course, it was just a, hey, how are things going? And I said, great, but who is this? And how'd you get my number? And it was this friend of Dan's again. And he said, I wanted to let you know I got your number from Dan's best friend. I wanted to let you know I only live 10 minutes from you, because there's going to be some bad weather, and if something happens at your house, you can call me. I'm only 10 minutes down the road. And I was like, okay, well, that's really nice. Thank you. And nothing happened, so I didn't call, and I didn't think about it, but a week goes by, and I get another text message. Hey, just checking in. Want to make sure everything's okay. You need your yard mowed. I'm like, no, I have a yard man. Thank you. That's really nice, but no. And I'm thinking, who is this person? So I call Dan's best friend, and I say, who did you give my number to? And he was like, oh, it's so-and-so. I'm like, oh, well, that's the person I had that great conversation with. So some time ticks by. Now, all of this, I'm saying time, but all of this happens over the span of about 4 weeks. And he sends me a text message and says, would you like to go to dinner as friends? And I'm like, yeah, I guess. Why not? So I meet him at a restaurant, we have dinners, and it was so fun, and it was so relaxed, and I drove home thinking, that was the weirdest thing. I don't know what to make of that. It was fun, it was very comfortable, but I don't know why, because I don't know that person. And the next week, I said, you know, that dinner was really fun. Maybe we can do that again. And he said, yeah, I would really like to. And we had the second dinner, and I was driving home, and I said, God, I totally understand. I see what you're doing. Now I don't know what to do about it because I'm very scared. So I just started praying a lot that I would be wise and be able to do the right thing and to know what I was supposed to do and what things were supposed to mean, because I haven't dated anybody in 11 years. I don't know how to do that. I've certainly never dated anybody with a child. I didn't even know if that's what we were doing. You know, I text my little brother, who's young and single, and said, what is this? And he said, I think you went on a date, and it's okay. And I was like, no, that's terrible. That's not okay. That wasn't what I intended to do. And we had a conversation about it, Jason and I did. And I said, you know, I don't really know what this is. I've never done this before. And I love Dan, and I miss Dan. And he said, I know you love Dan, and you're always going to love Dan, and I don't know what this is either, but I like you, and maybe we can kind of just hang out and see. And I said, okay, I guess that sounds okay, but don't tell anybody, because I don't want him to get the wrong idea. And so we kind of hang out a little bit, and within 3 weeks, I knew I was going to marry him. He was the kindest, most loving person I'd ever been around. So in September, which was 8 months after Dan died, Jason and I got married. And it has been blissful from that day forward. He's a pretty remarkable person. And he was supposed to be here tonight, and he's kind of in trouble because he's not. But he, you know, he came into a situation where he was just trying to be a friend. And had no intention. He had never been married before, no children, no nothing. He knew that Dan had been sick, and he was friends with Dan, and he was just trying to be a friend. And he said, I had no intention of ever falling in love with you. Why does this happen? And I said, yeah, I didn't either. And all that either one of us have been able to come up with is God. Because from the moment that I realized what was happening, I said, now I get it. I understand. I understand why we ended up where we ended up. I understood how our stories completely collided. And it was God. He led us to that. You know, to a person who does, he loves Conley like she were his own child. He loves Dan. He's able to understand that Conley and I love Dan. That everything that we've been through. And it's been pretty amazing from that moment on. And it's great because we still, even in our joy, as happy as we are every day, we all mourn Dan. And we miss him. And he's a part of our daily conversation. And, you know, we go together as a family and to the cemetery to put out flowers. And we do things to honor him. But it's not like a separate life. It's kind of like Jason was kind of always there. Even though I didn't know him, he was close enough with Dan that he understands. And so God really, you know, intervened and took something that was very hard and sad and turned it into something really beautiful and joyful. So that's my story in a nutshell.
Let me ask you a couple of things. There we go. So tell us what you do. What is your job? Because it has not always been your job.
No, okay. So I'm a nurse, but by trade a psychiatric nurse. That's been my passion forever. I love working with psychiatric patients. But after Dan passed away, I just felt really called to move into hospice care. The nurses and the nurse aides that came to our home were amazing. And so that's what I do now for about the last year.
I was able to see Brittany and Dan with hospice and now to see her. And when I am in homes for some of our members, and this is the hospice nurse, you can imagine the compassion and the love that those families feel, someone that understands where they've been. And to get to officiate Dan's funeral with all the friends and all the family, and then 8 months later to officiate the wedding was what a privilege of mine to be. It was very intimate. It was Jason, Brittany, Conley, and me.
And that was it.
And it was a beautiful, beautiful wedding of God's grace in that wedding. And the last thing, a little grace gift. Give us the grace gift.
I was like, what? What's the gift? So we just found out that we are expecting a baby. So...